Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 2nd of February. It took almost all of human history for the number of people on this earth to reach 1 billion, and that happened in the 1800s. And then it took only about a century to add the second billion by 1930. We added the third billion in just 30 years and the fourth in only 15 years. We are now at 6.7 billion people, and the projections are there will be 2 billion more to come in the next 40 years. Our guests today say the size and the growth of the human population is linked closely to nearly all forms of environmental degradation that we see today, from mass extinction, climate change, the toxification of the environment, and desertification to aquifer depletion, ocean dead zones, deforestation, dying coral reefs, and collapsing fisheries. Population plays a role in all of that. John Feeney is an environmental writer with articles in the BBC News, The Guardian, and The Oil Drum. He invited scientists and others all over the world to pledge to speak out publicly in this month, the month of February, on the problem of the size and growth of the human population, an underreported topic, he says. He is with us for this hour to talk about this issue, as is Professor Jeffrey McGee. Professor McGee is a professor of anthropology at Ohio State University and author of Sparing Nature, The Conflict Between Human Population Growth and Earth's Biodiversity. For you to join this conversation, and a couple of you have already called in, I think we'll have a lot of calls, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. John, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks, Kathleen. Thanks for having us on.
Yeah, and Professor McKee, thank you so much for being with us.
It's my pleasure to join you.
Yeah. John, let's start with you, who has organized this speak out during the course of this month. You've said that this is a topic that people haven't talked about openly, as openly as they should. Why?
Well, it's a somewhat complicated history, but there have been forces really from both the left and the right for several decades now that have essentially suppressed discussion of this. One of the key areas where it's been suppressed is that you'll notice that pretty much none of the major environmental organizations today talk about population very much at all. And the reason is, as I mentioned, there are forces from the left and the right. On the right, you have had, over the years, economists and the corporate world feeling that we need population to maintain a growing economy, that we need population growth to maintain a growing economy. And then you've also had some religious groups. The Catholic Church has been influential in suppressing talk of numbers and ideas such as contraception.
Mm-hmm.
As well, on the left, beginning in about the 70s, a lot of the environmental groups in the U.S. anyway, began to have among their staff people who came not from conservation backgrounds, but more from human rights backgrounds. And I'm certainly all for human rights, and don't get me wrong on that. But these folks began to be concerned that any effort to do anything to influence human numbers was going to be, in some way, a violation of human rights.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, no, we can't focus on human numbers. So a lot of this culminated in 1994 in the UN's at that time, once per decade conference that they held concerning population, and that one was in Cairo. And at the Cairo conference, a number of activist groups got together and were very well organized and managed to influence policy at that conference such that there was an agreement that we would no longer talk about numbers very much. We would no longer talk about population per se, but we would talk mostly just about things like reproductive health and promoting women's rights, which they knew correctly are linked with population growth. And if we can promote women's education, women's rights, those sorts of things, then it tends to reduce fertility rates and reduce population growth. But along the way, they kind of lost all the language of population, from numbers to words like overpopulation were kind of brushed under the carpet, so that we've kind of lost focus on the need to address numbers out of perhaps on the left too much concern out of too much concern for violating human rights, when in fact there are very humane and empowering ways to go about this, and on the right, as I mentioned, these economic concerns.
Interesting. Professor, you have written pretty dramatically about this article I was reading, Brother, Can You Spare a Species?, a dramatic title. The detrimental effects of another species for nearly, not just recently, but for nearly 2 million years, you write, human population growth continues to affect biodiversity in a profound way today. Let's talk about that. What way?
Well, you know, using my anthropological perspective, I looked back through time and looked at rates of extinction of particularly mammals, because they're most easily documented. And we see that as the human population grows, more and more species have gone extinct, and it's accelerated particularly over the last 10,000 years. But it's accelerating even more today, to the point that 11% of known species are threatened with extinction. And my colleagues and I got together and thought, well, let's look at the species that are threatened today, see if there's any correlation with human population growth. And what we found is that, country by country, human population density is strongly correlated with the number of species of plants and animals that are threatened with extinction. And so, in the distant past, there have been 5 mass extinctions, and it's become quite clear that right now we are in the midst of a 6th mass extinction, and it's the first mass extinction that's really caused by one species, and in particular, by the growth of one particular species, and that's us.
Well, that'll make you sit up and take notice and say, we probably ought to look at some ways to keep this from happening, because if we're going to be so arrogant, eventually it's going to come back and kill us, isn't it?
Well, eventually. Approaching it from a conservation point of view isn't going to be enough. And ironically, it's some of the conservationists who kind of don't want to talk about population because they think that issues of population will detract from issues of conservationist species.
Mm-hmm.
But certainly they're tied. They're one and the same in the way I view the world and in the way my data speak about the world. And so I'm all for conservation, obviously, but it has to be done in such a way that done in concert with not only stopping the growth of the human population, but actually decreasing the size of the human population to a sustainable level.
Mm-hmm. And will it reach a point, both of you, I'd like to have you address this, that we will find maybe violent means to, that we're more likely to go to war, we're more likely to kill each other off and in pretty violent ways if we don't address this in a peaceful manner, because we know instinctively that we can't live with this many people on Earth. So we'll find some way to get rid of people.
Sure. The classic ways in which populations come down when they are too high, eventually they come down through famine, disease, and competition, other species. That competition translates into war in humans. So those are kind of the 3 biggies. Anyway, nature can make it happen. It'll eventually make it happen if we don't voluntarily and humanely do something about this.
Mm-hmm.
So I tell my students that there are 2 ways to reduce the size of the human population. One is to decrease the birth rate. The other is to increase the death rate. And I think decreasing the birth rate is obviously the better option there. And, I mean, you talk about war, and there are wars going on now. There are famines going on now. There's all sorts of global conflict. Yet every single day, the human population grows by over 218,000 people, despite all those wars, despite the famines, despite the diseases, despite the natural disasters. I mean, that, just to put it in perspective for your listening audience there, if we add 218,000 people a day to this planet, it would take 25 days, just 25 days, to get to the population of the size of Wisconsin. just 25 days.
My.
And obviously that's not sustainable.
Right.
And so we need to raise the consciousness of people about this issue. Back in the 60s, when consciousness of this issue was raised, the birth rate in the United States, at least, actually went down for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the more people are aware, then the more they can do about it. If you're not aware of a problem, you're not going to do anything. But
right.
if you're aware of it, then you can actually actively reduce the birth rate.
Mm-hmm.
And can I just emphasize that
yeah, sure.
it's precisely the question you asked, Kathleen, that is the reason this is so important. The whole key to this is an effort to try to avert a massive amount of human suffering and death. And that's why I'm very concerned about people who jump to the first thought that comes to their mind is, well, this is a violation of human rights if you do anything about population numbers. But what is the greater violation of human rights? To try our best to institute humane policies that would help resolve this, or to allow us to continue not doing anything, essentially, and allow a kind of collapse or crash of human numbers take place.
Yeah, I'd like to take up on a point that John made earlier. We found in country after country that empowering women is probably the best means of reducing population growth. So that's an important part of it, and that's an increase in human rights, not a decrease in human rights.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a very effective one at that, but we must, again, not lose sight of the numbers and the things that other organizations have kind of put aside.
Right. Do we have, and I wonder how we would get to this number, if indeed we have a number, of 218,000 being born every day, which is just astounding to me.
That's not the number of being born. That's the net gain.
The net gain.
Day.
Okay. And so what should it be?
Right now, it should be zero.
It should be zero.
As a matter of fact, I wrote an article a couple years ago suggesting that probably the best size population that would be sustainable, at least from the perspective of the natural world and biodiversity losses, would be about 3 billion people. So actually, my personal preference would be to move toward population reduction.
Hmm.
Absolutely, and other estimates are even lower than that often. So it really, the countries that are, I don't know if this is quite the right way to put it, but doing the right thing right now are, in my opinion, some of the European countries, for instance, which are at below replacement fertility rates. They're having like 1.6, 1.7 children per woman of childbearing age. So in time, if they continue that, it can allow population to shrink.
Mm-hmm.
There are immigration issues that get involved in that, so they may maintain populations through immigration. But we need the world's total fertility rate to actually be sub-replacement for some period of time.
Mm-hmm. And what about those programs, and I know they are taking place, to empower women in countries that are poor across the earth? Professor McKee, how have they been able to lower birth rates successfully?
Well, as women are more empowered, they have more decision-making power, essentially, within their families as well as within the communities. And they tend to put off childbearing in the interest of employment, for one, or community leadership, or there's lots of other things to do in life other than just take care of children. Now, I love taking care of my children, but there's other things to do. And the more the females can have a role outside of the family, there just seems to be a natural consequence that they have fewer children.
How big a thing was it for President Obama to sign an executive order essentially changing the U.S. position on family planning policies around the country? John?
That was big. That was a very positive step. The Mexico City policy, also known as the global gag rule, had for years been restricting the ability of foreign NGOs to provide family planning resources and services. The rule was in place saying that any foreign NGO that, is in, to put put it simply, that any foreign NGO that had anything to do with abortion, even if it was just referring people out to some place where abortions might be available, could not be provided U.S. funds for family planning services. So, and it, what it essentially did was defunded a lot of NGOs, which was definitely a setback regarding population.
Mm-hmm. This is something that's gone back and forth between administrations. The global gag rule started with the Reagan administration, and then the Clinton administration did pretty much what the Obama administration has just done in rescinding that global gag rule. So it's gone back and forth, but still, you know, the underlying problem has to do with population growth, and the more we talk about that in any way is going to be beneficial. One thing that Obama said in his inaugural address is that we will restore science to its rightful place. And I think if we do restore science to its rightful place and we do pay attention to the numbers and we do look at what is actually going on this planet, then it will require us to act. And that's what the Global Population Speak Out is all about.
Mm-hmm. Let's welcome phone calls. We have a lot of people who want to speak out on this issue on hold. Our guests are John Feeney, environmental writer and organizer of Global Population Speak Out. Professor Jeffrey McKee is a professor of anthropology at Ohio State University and author of Sparing Nature, The Conflict Between Human Population Growth and Earth's Biodiversity. 800-486-8655 is the number. I'm Kathleen Dunn, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to your phone calls now, starting with Peter from Madison. Hi, Peter.
Hi there. You know, one of the things I think which is a great impediment to this whole concept is kind of under the big umbrella of dominionism and how many religions frame rights based upon your gender, that men are at the focal point, and especially men of a certain color. And sort of a colloquial thing, and that you notice that in our country, women weren't given a right to vote until 1919. And how the amazing thing is how tribal and everything else we are, from Barack Obama to worrying about Hillary Clinton being elected, that you go to other countries around the world, and it just seems like it's autopilot. You know, it's just like you have a child. I kind of frame it, I call it the peacock years, of how marketers in this country and abroad are so heavily interested in the 18 to 34-year-old demographic just because they're buying stuff to get noticed. And as you get older, you downsize. And I think one of the things people don't realize as you get older, the procreative urge is gone, so there's not as much apparent need, at least in terms of relative amounts, to try to get noticed. And how we're just so unconscious of this. We run around buying Priuses and recycling paper, and all these things are just simple window dressings to the big issue of why the heck have a baby when there are billions of people living under $5 a day. What is in your mind about adding more to the human population? I just don't get it. And I don't understand why the Sierra Club and these other groups, Conservation Congress, don't point first to the pink elephant, then worry about these trinkets, about the Priuses and everything else after that. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks very much for the call. John, you want to start? I'd like to hear both of you respond.
Well, with regard to his last question, I think there are probably complicated reasons behind it, but I think essentially you can look at the money for why the Sierra Club and other organizations don't talk about this. They're afraid of losing funding if they offend or cross too many of their constituents, their supporters. And then the Sierra Club, in particular, went through a big brouhaha some years ago regarding immigration. They used to talk about concerns about immigration into the U.S. and its contribution to U.S. population growth, and they had a big split within their members on that issue, and there was a large funding issue involved in it. And they decided not to talk about that. But even worse, they pretty much don't talk about global population growth either. If you look at their website, you'll find an obscure couple of pages somewhere on population.
but I get emails from them almost every day, and never are the emails about population growth, never are their campaigns about it. So the caller is absolutely right about that. And I'm kind of sticking with the point of environmental organizations, because I think it's very important here. These organizations need to start, you know, talking about the truth, and population is simply one of the key drivers of environmental degradation. I mean, it multiplies with per capita consumption to determine our total resource consumption, and they're looking only at per capita consumption and, you know, things like going green and new kinds of light bulbs and maybe fighting things like the use of coal and nuclear and so on. Mm-hmm. But they're not talking about this one of the two key factors that multiply to produce total consumption. So, yeah, you know, I think a lot of times it has to do with fears of compromised funding, not wanting to offend their members.
Mm-hmm. Professor McKee.
I think a lot of it has to do more generally, just outside of these organizations, but culturally in general, there is a complete lack of awareness of the problem. And I think if we raise that awareness, something's going to happen. So, for example, in the 1970s, everyone was driving these small, fuel-efficient cars because there's great awareness about pollution and oil prices and all sorts of things. When that awareness went away, then everyone went back to, you know, driving SUVs and gas guzzlers, mm-hmm. and things like that. Likewise with population, in the 1960s, there was a bit of awareness of that. And as I mentioned earlier, the growth rate in the United States came down a little bit. But there's just generally no awareness. And I think, you know, I was unaware of the extent of the problem until, you know, in the last 15 years or so. But now, you know, if I go to a restaurant and I see a family come in and I see, you know, six kids or something like that, I hate myself for this, but I tend to look down on them, you know. And I think if society in general started thinking about that differently, started looking down on people who irresponsibly have too many kids, then things would change dramatically. But without that awareness, without that sort of cultural infusion, it's not going to happen. And it's not happening on the political scale either. In all these debates we had for the presidential election, population didn't come up once, not once at all.
Mm-hmm.
And it's one of the key issues facing humanity, and it didn't come up. So we need to make our political leaders more aware of it as well, in hopes that they can make the general populace more aware.
Yeah, you know, it didn't even come up in terms of, and so much has been made of, because of the number of doctors and the number of babies, the octuplets, and the woman already had six children. Even then, which is a pretty dramatic story, it didn't come up in terms of that debate, that that's too many children because of what's happened in the world and overpopulation, right?
Right. You know, I'm amazed by the eight children, but I'm more disturbed by the six children that came previously. That, you know, big families are nice, but the human population just can't afford that anymore.
Yeah. As a point of interest on that, one of our pledgers for the Global Population Speak Out, Dr. Pip Hayes in Great Britain, was featured in an article in the Times in the UK yesterday, and she has stated that she will not provide fertility treatments to couples who already have large families. If someone comes to her and they already have four kids or something, she will not she'll refer them out and refuse herself to provide fertility treatments to them.
Hmm.
So I think there is some, you know, certainly some increase in awareness there. But as Jeff said, we've got to get a lot more awareness in general. And as he was mentioning, back in the 60s and 70s, there was more talk about it. Paul Ehrlich, who wrote
Sure.
The Population Bomb and is also one of the endorsers of our project, was on The Tonight Show something like 20 times.
Really?
During
The
70s. So, you know, that's just night and day different from today.
Right.
You don't see someone like that on David Letterman or The Tonight Show very often today.
Hmm. Let's go next to Kurt from Springbrook. Hi, Kurt.
Hi. I see this as a biological problem. On a yearly basis, we're increasing our food supply, and as a result, we're increasing our population. And just like any biological species, if you increase their food supply, you're going to increase their population. And I find that's not talked about, that the food supply issue with us. And it seems like we have to, first of all, stabilize how much food we're producing globally to start to even stabilize our population. Otherwise, it's not going to work.
That is a very interesting and important argument, I think. It's the argument that has been popularized in a couple of works of fiction by Daniel Quinn, suggesting that, as with any other species, if you keep increasing the food supply available to that species, the numbers of that species will continue to rise. It's a very tough sell among most people, though, because the first thing that comes to mind for them is they think, well, if we stop growing the food supply, we'll increase starvation. But then on the other hand, they say, well, a lot of food is thrown away today, and the distribution is the real problem that's causing starvation. We're producing more than we actually need globally. So it's an argument that's a little bit complex and tricky. I think it definitely deserves a lot more attention. It's not getting any because of the difficulty in getting past the concern about increased starvation. If listeners want to read Daniel Quinn's books, Ishmael and the Story of Bee, he makes a very convincing case in there that it would not increase starvation to stop growing the global food supply. And he makes possibly an even more convincing case that you know, we would never have gotten to a population of 6.7 billion had the global food supply just remained level back at the point where it was when we were at, say, 1 billion. You can't make people out of nothing. You have to make, they're made out of food. So it's a very interesting argument, I think, that does deserve more attention. But as I said, it's a tough sell right now.
Yes. What I would add to that is that, I mean, this has been going on for the last 10,000 years, which is why so many species are going extinct. But as you increase the food supply, you increase generally the amount of land you use for agriculture. Mm-hmm. That automatically displaces a lot of other species, natural species, and that's why they're threatened with extinction. So it's almost directly a correlation between agriculture and species extinctions. The problem with that is it's not sustainable, because if all these other species start to go extinct, and that changes the entire ecological system of the planet, it's going to change our weather patterns, it's going to change our soils, it's going to change quite a few things. So there are consequences, severe consequences, for us in the long run if we keep on increasing agricultural lands.
Mm-hmm. You were talking earlier about fertility doctors who are not going to give services to people who already have so many children. Do you think both of you think that we need sort of a one-child policy or a two-child policy similar to China? Do governments need to take that up?
Well, there are certainly some thoughtful population activists out there who are pushing for something like a one-child policy. They think it could be democratically voted in. My position right now is that there is so much we're not doing in terms of simple, voluntary, empowering methods, the kinds of things such as women's education and empowerment, making family planning resources widely and easily available, and also media strategies. There's a unique organization in the U.S. called the Population Media Center. Bill Ryerson, the president of that, is one of our endorsers on this project, and they use strategies. They are involved in working in a number of countries around the world right now. They go in, and in conjunction with the people of those countries, they produce soap operas, and these soap operas portray families doing things. They'll portray couples making decisions, for instance, to stop at two children, or maybe to stop at one child, or making a decision to have the wife go back to school to get a degree, and portray them doing things like going to the family planning clinic and consulting on family planning questions. So, these strategies actually have a proven track record. They've done research and found, you know, before one of these soap operas airs, the they'll measure the usage of local family planning clinics and then look at a year later after the show has been on and find that usage of those clinics has gone way up.
Mm.
And they've measured drops in fertility rates as a result of these strategies. And so I think that using that kind of strategy, the women's empowerment and education, increasing family planning resources, putting all those things together, there's so much we're not doing in that that some people believe that those things will never be enough. But we really don't know, I think, until we do a whole lot more of that. And we can do it all around the world, including the U.S., by the way, where 49% of pregnancies right now are unplanned.
49%.
49%.
Goodness. Thanks, Kurt, very much for the call. Ron from Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi. I want to focus a little bit on the question of military strategies to affect population growth. There are elements of eugenics. There's elements of military strategies. Question is, I believe that civil wars are created. Both sides are armed by the same governments, by the U.S., Russia, France, China, and England. We arm both sides in hoping that the two populations will kill each other off and reduce population. I think population control is at the center of major military activities around the world and, of course, the control by governments of smaller populations, governments wanting to have more control. Can you speak to that? And I'll give you one example. Israel will not allow the right of return to Palestinians because there'll be too many Palestinians in Israel. The population will increase, and they'll take over the Israeli government if they're given an equal vote, if they're allowed to return. And so there's a kind of politicized meaning we pick a group that's opposed to the current government and try to eliminate them.
Okay, well, hold you there because your call is a little noisy here, but because there are other people talking, but we got what you're saying. John, you want to start?
I have no way of knowing if there are militaries around the world or governments behind the scenes saying let's promote war in this case to try to reduce population numbers. I tend to doubt it because I think actually you can reduce numbers by quite a lot more simply by reducing birth rates than you could by killing people, unless you're talking about global nuclear war or something. But I don't have any way of knowing if that's going on. That seems to be one of the objections that comes up occasionally when people object to addressing population. They'll say, oh, well, there are these government entities talking about this and wanting to cause a mass human die-off. If there are, they should be outed and repudiated, and then population should continue to be addressed for the legitimate problem that it is.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's my suspicion that military endeavors are much more economically motivated than motivated by population considerations. But I think, in general, the whole point is that we want this to be a cultural change, not a military change. We don't want to have to, engage military activity just to keep population numbers down. We want it to be a much more peaceful and cultural type of thing.
Right.
Let's go next to Victoria from Appleton. Hello, Victoria.
Hi, Kathleen, and thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I just want to applaud your guest for bringing this topic up and on the bandwagon to really have the world population look at the explosion of our population. I guess two books that they brought out, Ehrlich's book and Daniel Quinn's book, are two required reading for everybody who is concerned about this issue. And I was calling about bringing fertility doctors into the mix, and that was addressed by your guest. And I just want to add, maybe it's time to even not have doctors be specialists in fertility. When we look at the number of children who are longing for a home through adoption, is there the need for fertility doctors? Because it is getting so out of hand, and I do applaud the one female fertility doctor that they mentioned who is refusing to, aid in pregnancy through fertility. We have this woman that was in the news who had 6 children already and now just gave birth to octuplets. It's ridiculous, and I'm really concerned that, you know, our media, it's not just other, you know, countries' media, but, there's such a glorification of family today. And we see these reality programs, the family that has 18 children, they go on Oprah, and Oprah is joyous about, you know, this big, happy family. We do have to start having some PSAs about population explosion. And I'll take my comments off the air.
Okay, Victoria. Thanks so much for the call. John, you want to start?
Yeah, well, good points. And I think it also highlights that this is certainly an issue in the U.S. It's not, there's no finger pointing on my part or most population activists' part toward only developing countries. In the U.S., our population is growing and fertility rates are above replacement. And yeah, as she mentioned, there is this sort of glorification right now of amazingly large families, actually, and it needs to, instead of being glorified, I think it needs to be seen as, wow, that's a problem. Why would someone have, you know, 18 children, for God's sake?
Mm-hmm.
I'd rather look at it the other way. She mentioned the concept of glorification of family. Well, I think on our side, we should glorify the family as well, but glorify much smaller families.
Sure.
So, you know, I'm a family man as well, and I wouldn't want to take that away from anybody.
Sure.
Yeah, this is not anti-family in any way. We're just saying that we do need to look at the numbers.
Exactly.
More phone calls in a moment. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. John Feeney, environmental writer and organizer for Global Population Speak Out, which is taking place all over the world during the month of February. And Professor Jeffrey McKee, he is a professor of anthropology at Ohio State University and author of Sparing Nature, The Conflict Between Human Population Growth and Earth's Biodiversity. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to more phone calls now. Deborah from Madison. Hi, Deborah.
Hi. One point that I had was, you know, if it's so easy for the left and the right to cover up an issue like this, to make it so that nobody talks about population growth, we have to wonder, you know, what of what gets put on the table can we believe is actually important if this is such an important issue? And I think those of us that, care about this kind of thing know how important it is. But if, you know, we have to wonder if what of what's on the table actually is important, if something this important can get covered up so well. And the second point is, this is a very, I'm sure, hot-button issue, and I don't think it'd go over well, but I wonder about creating an incentive for people to start using better birth control, especially people who keep having children who can't afford it, and those kids end up with lives that none of us would ever want to have.
Professor McKee, you want to start with a response?
I'm not quite sure how to respond to that, other than that, it isn't a red-blue issue or a left and right issue. It's a global issue, and we really need to get people from all different perspectives together to start raising the consciousness of the population on this issue. That's all I really have to say on that.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thanks, Deborah, very much for your call. Let us go next to Christy from Dubuque, Iowa. Hi, Christy.
Hello. Thank you for having me on.
Mm-hmm.
I believe it needs to start on a government level. I know it's another delicate subject. I think Deborah was just speaking of, we're way too generous with our public aid. People are rewarded for having children in this country, and kids equal cash. They see that, and it passes on through generations. You see people 16 years old having kids because they see their parents having 10 kids and getting paid, you know, for it. And I think there needs to be a limit. Maybe after 2, the government doesn't help anymore.
Yeah, I agree. There are tax policies in place that do reward having more children, and I think one of the first steps would be to shift those so that isn't happening. And there are other countries as well that have financial incentives in place for having larger families because they have economic concerns about loss of population. So I think those kinds of things really need to be reversed because the economic concerns and the challenges they would present really pale in comparison to the challenge face that we would face if we continue as we are and start looking at things like global ecological collapse, which is, you know, is certainly in the cards right now. So, yeah, there are policies, financial incentives that can be reversed to, at the very least, be neutral rather than promoting larger families. And there are certainly people who think it would make sense also to maybe reverse those policies and aim the incentive toward having smaller families rather than larger families.
Mm-hmm. I mean, didn't we go through that, though, with welfare reform in this country? A lot of people, poor people in this country, were going to work, and I'm wondering if, and there weren't the cash payments for staying at home for people who don't have any money. Did that result in a lower birth rate, do you think? Have we checked on that?
That I don't have an answer to. But I do agree with John that our incentive policies should change and can change. When I talk to my students about this, they suggest things like, well, why don't we have a tax for children? I mean, they are a liability to society, so if you're going to have children, you should pay taxes rather than get reduced taxes on them. I don't know if we need to go that far or not, but eventually we would have to go to something like that if we don't become more proactive right now.
Yeah, which points to the fact also that if we don't become more proactive right now, down the road, that's when we might be forced to look at things like one-child policies, and they would seem maybe quite innocuous to us compared to the threats that we're facing at that point. And so rather than face those threats and have to impose something like a one-child policy when things have degraded to that point, why don't we be looking at these very humane, empowering, and relatively well-accepted approaches right now much more closely so that maybe we can turn things around a lot sooner.
Thank you for the call. We go next to Steele from Nina. Hi, Steele.
Yeah, good morning, everyone. Yeah, speaking of the guests had mentioned in the Times paper in England, fertility doctors talking, and in the last 2 days I've been looking online at papers, and European papers are wondering more about the morality of it, and in the U.S. papers they're talking about, she might be getting some money from Oprah or some other show, and so we have the monetary, you know, kind of that way she can afford an $8,000 Super Bowl ticket. And you were mentioning soap operas, and a while back someone was talking about comic books used for education. Like when I used to go to laundromats, I would see, you know, the papers of, you know, talking about Jesus. Well, maybe we should have educational literature and put it out in places where people can read it too. And well, I got a lot of other things, but anyway,
that's it for a start. That's a good start. Thanks, Steele, for the call, Professor McKee.
He mentions morality, and I think the whole concept of morality is one of the reasons why people don't talk about this issue. But it's a difficult discussion to talk about morality because people view morality in very different ways. But if we don't have the discussion, then we're not going to get anywhere. So we got to get over that fear of getting into those deep and difficult discussions and actually have them, but toward making the most humane policy possible to keep our population at a sustainable level.
Mm-hmm. Exactly, and that one of the best examples of not talking about this because it's, you know, difficult, uncomfortable thing to talk about is from what I've heard from two pretty good sources in different parts of the world, the IPCC, the Panel on Climate Change, has in place a kind of tacit agreement not to talk about population growth, even though they're well aware that it is a key driver
of
climate change. And they don't talk about it because they say, well, that's just too controversial.
Huh. Let's play this out. We have an email of people wondering if our population growth continues to the extent that it is, what's ahead of us? What's down the road? What's the worst-case scenario?
Well, I think the worst-case scenario is essentially global ecological collapse and societal collapse. I mean, it sounds like, you know, a gloom and doom kind of thing, and it sounds almost too horrible to be possible, but it's really not an exaggeration to say that civilization as we know it could be threatened down the road.
Yeah, and, you know, John's right, because, you know, I looked at this from a scientific perspective, and, you know, if this continues, then my point in sparing nature is that a lot of other species of plants and animals are going to go extinct. And when that happens, that can get into sort of a negative feedback loop where we do get to complete ecological collapse. Now, a lot of people are less concerned about that, but it does play out economically. That's what we've got to get across. It's a pocketbook issue for everybody. It's a moral issue for everybody that we need to talk about. But certainly in a worst-case scenario, we're looking at a great increase in human misery, as Thomas mm-hmm. Malthus would have put it.
Mm-hmm. And as Jeff's book, Sparing Nature, the topic that it's about, this mass extinction event we're facing and the link to population, Jeff could probably correct my figures, but I know that, for instance, biologist E.O. Wilson has estimated that we could be on track to lose as many as half of all species by the end of this century with a business-as-usual approach. And that's the kind of thing where, you know, we can't afford to lose half of all species. I mean, we don't know what kinds of cascade effects might be down the road. You lose one species and it triggers losses of several others. This is the web of life, and mm-hmm. We depend on it. And it's like right now, our life support system is having its lines cut one by one by one by one.
Mm. Yeah. If you take the minimum estimate of how many species are going extinct right now, this is the minimum, and you take an estimate of 12 million species or so, it would take just over 1,300 years for all species to go extinct. Mm. 1,300 years might seem like a long time, and you might be able to sleep tonight, but, you know, in the kind of time scales I deal with, in millions and millions of years, I mean, that's an instant.
Right. Sure. Let's go to Tim from Ladysmith. Hi, Tim.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I guess I'm going to be the lone dissenter. While I'm sure your guests are very sincere, and obviously they sound very sincere and belief, they're looking at it from one side of the mountain. I find what they're saying very disturbing and very alarming personally. I think in the hands of the wrong people, this kind of philosophy will absolutely lend itself to human genocide and the extinction of different groups of people. It sounds very moral up front. Yes, we need to do this for the long term. The problem with this conversation is a worldview that devalues human life to the species of animals. Human beings are not animals. Human beings are above animals. The problem with this philosophy is when you start saying to people, the governments of the world are going to tell you what kind of how many children you can have. That is very disturbing to me. Another issue that your guest alluded to earlier was what was going on in Europe. The only thing he fails to say is that while Europeans are depopulating, the Muslim population in Europe is exploding. And so I find this, I guess I'm looking at it from a different point of view, and I would be opposed to government-sanctioned control of families in any way, shape, or form.
Okay, Tim, thanks for the call.
I'd like to jump in on that, because I find it good that you find this discussion alarming. That's kind of the point. And I find it very good that you find it disturbing that this could lead to something along the lines of genocide, because that's exactly what we want to avoid.
Mm-hmm.
With this awareness of population issue, we want cultural change, not genocide.
Yeah, it's not putting other species ahead of humans. It is noting the link between all species and that humans do depend on other species, and the desperate need to prevent a massive loss of human life as a result of continued carrying capacity overshoot.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly.
We have time for one more call. It will have to be somewhat quick. Mark from Janesville. Hi.
Hi, Kathleen. Thanks for getting me on. I guess I would echo the comment that Tim was making, in that I find it very disturbing as well, and that I think one of the drawbacks to depopulation and we're going to start seeing it in our country here in the next couple of decades, is our systems are built on a continual growth model. And I'm not saying that's the best way to go, but that is the only economic system that we've got at this point. And as we start to depopulate, I think our system's going to go down to the tank. You know, we're going to see that with the explosion of the baby boomers into retirement. And if we don't have, you know, more than enough workers, you know, in the economic system to support them, we're going to be in a world of hurt. Mm. And, you know, I guess I did agree with some of the comments that the guests made as far as fertility clinics and, you know, do we really need fertility clinics? Mm-hmm. Aren't there, you know, babies out there that need, you know, good homes?
Right, and I'll let everybody think on that because we are plumb out of time. Well, it raises a lot of profound questions, the whole issue. John and Jeffrey, thank you so much. A very, very interesting hour. Thanks.
Thanks, Kathleen. Mm-hmm. Glad to be on.
Yeah, our pleasure.
Thank you very much.
John Feeney is a writer, environmental writer, organizer for Global Population Speak Out, and Professor Jeffrey McKee is a professor of anthropology at Ohio State University, author of Sparing Nature, The Conflict Between Human Population Growth and Earth's Biodiversity. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour, to Rob Schroeder for on-air production here in our studios, and thanks for listening. Until tomorrow.